welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Art Markman, who is the author of Smart Change, 5 Tools to Create New and Sustainable Habits in Yourself and Others. Dr. Mattman is a psychologist, and he's the author of Smart Thinking and Habits of Leadership, and he's on the faculty of the University of Texas, and writes regularly for Huffington Post, Fast Company, Psychology Today, Harvard Business Review, and is here to help us develop good habits and break bad habits. Welcome, Dr. Markman. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here this morning.
So, you want to tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you got interested in changing human behavior?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a cognitive psychologist by training, so that means that I spend my time studying the way that people think and act. And one of the things that really comes up a lot in thinking about the way that people act is that so much of what we do is actually driven by the habits that we have. And so that's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, a lot of time studying. And independently of that, it also began to occur to me after I was writing a lot of these papers that get read by 30 of my closest colleagues that almost everyone I know has a mind and almost nobody knows how it works, which means that I watch a lot of people doing things that probably work at cross purposes to the way that their brain is working. And rather than watching everybody continue to struggle with things like making New Year's resolutions every year that fail, I thought, you know, if we could present people with a little bit more information about the way the mind works, then people might begin to do things a little bit differently and a little bit more effectively. And so that really got me thinking about how to help other people to make changes in their behavior.
Well, that sounds wonderful. This first book that you wrote, Smart Thinking and Habits of Leadership, was that something that was, the beginnings of your determining how we think and how the habits that we get into when we think?
Yeah, so as a cognitive psychologist, because I spend all this time doing research on the way that people think, there's an awful lot that goes into that research that helps us to understand what the principles of effective thinking are. And so with smart thinking, what I did was to really say, you know, you can boil down a lot of what makes people excellent problem solvers, creative thinkers. You can boil that down into three components, one of which is the habits that we have, and particularly the habits we have around learning and thinking. But in addition to that, an important part of the way that we think has to do with our ability to maximize the quality of the knowledge that we have, and then we need to develop strategies that help us to use all of the knowledge that we've gathered in the situations in which we need it. And I realized that despite the fact that all of us go through an education system that generally gives us about 13 years of education, and then many of us go on to college after that, we learn a lot of facts and we learn a lot of information, but we don't learn a lot about how the mind is actually taking all of that information and using it. And so understanding that a little bit more can help people to tweak the way that they study, the way that they learn information, and consequently the way that they use that.
So in your book, Smart Change, you begin to talk about the problem of changing behaviors. And this is primarily because much of what we do is habitual. Mm-hmm. Would you like to address that?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, if you think about it, most of your life is actually driven by doing what you did last time, which is, by the way, a great thing. I mean, think about waking up in the morning in your own home. You get up, you know exactly where to reach to shut your alarm off. You can go through your entire morning routine getting washed and dressed without having to think about all the details of how to do that. And that allows you to plan your day and think about what's coming up. If you're in a hotel, for example, then suddenly nothing's where it's supposed to be. It's hard to find your toothbrush. It could take you 5 minutes to figure out how the shower works. It's almost as if by the time you get yourself dressed in the morning, you're exhausted already because of how much effort it took just to get yourself ready for the day. So our habits are generally speaking a really good thing, and the brain is really organized as much as possible not to think, but rather to do what we did last time. The problem is that every once in a while, we have a set of habits that cause us to fail systematically at important goals that we'd like to achieve. We might spend our entire workday checking email rather than taking care of some of the big projects that we want to do. Or closer to home, we might end up eating too many chips and snacks and consequently have a lot of clothes we don't fit in so well anymore. And in that case, those habits are now getting in our way, and unfortunately we're now fighting against this very well-designed, very efficient habit learning system. We're fighting against that when we try to change our behavior, and we often go about it the wrong way, which is part of the reason why we end up falling back into those habits.
So one thing I guess we have to determine is what habits we are targeting to change. So
yeah.
How do you optimize your goals?
Yeah. So there are several intersecting facets to this. The first is you have to realize that there's something that you'd like to achieve that you're systematically failing to achieve. And that's the target for you of where your behavior change needs to start. After that, I tell people that it's really important to spend about 2 weeks observing their own behavior before they really get ready to change their behavior. Because until you know where those habits are coming from, and until you understand when you're doing the things that you want to change, it's very hard to make a change. And so I actually recommend taking about 2 weeks and forming a habit diary. In fact, I have this website, smartthinkingbook.com, and there's a tab on that for the book Smart Change. And there's actually a free Smart Change Journal you can download, and it's got a habit diary in it to get people really ready to think about those habits. Now, even after we identify the habits we want to go after and the behaviors we want to change, at that point it's really important to state the goal in the right way, because a lot of us fail at our attempts to change behavior in the moment that we state what the goal is. For example, we often set negative goals, things like I'm going to eat less or I'm going to stop mm-hmm. checking my email so often. The problem mm-hmm. with those negative goals is that they are focusing us on trying to stop our behavior, when in fact the most important thing that we can do is to actually learn to create new behaviors, because your habits are actually a part of your memory. And you can't erase memory. What you can do is to overwrite it by changing the way that the environment, the world, is associated with behaviors. So if you spend all of your time trying to stop behaviors, then you end up failing because you're not reprogramming those habits. Instead, what you want to do is to create positive behaviors you can perform that can ultimately form the basis for a new set of habits. So you have to get the goal right if you're going to have any chance of succeeding at making that change in your behavior.
So the goals have to be something positive or definitive. Like
right.
If you're trying to lose weight, getting into a smaller dress size maybe. Is that right?
Well, interesting question, right? So getting into a smaller dress size or losing 10 pounds has a slightly different potential problem with it, which is that it's an outcome goal. And the mm-hmm. danger with outcome goals is that once you reach them, it's not clear that you've created a set of behaviors that will sustain you in the long term. So in fact, what you want to do is to focus on something positive, like, here's the way I'm going to eat now. So for example, I lost a lot of weight about 10 years ago, and one of the ways that I did that was to move to a plant-based diet. And the reason mm-hmm. that I did that was because if I continued to eat all of the foods that I'd been eating before, it was going to be very hard to change behavior, because I'd constantly have to remember, while I'm doing this thing I've always done and have all these habits around, I somehow have to stop myself. By completely changing the nature of the foods I was eating, I could now develop a new set of routines of spooning a certain amount of food into a bowl, eating that, eating foods that were a little bit lower in fats and things like that. And mm-hmm. and by doing that, that's a set of actions I can perform. It's a set of habits I can create. And in the long term, it's a process. Now, as a side effect of changing that diet and exercising a little bit more often, I also lost weight. But the focus wasn't on the weight loss. It wasn't on the amount of weight. It was on the process for living life, where the key outcomes you desired were a side effect of the way that I was carrying out my day-to-day actions.
When I was in my early 30s, I quit smoking, and I did it at the same time I became vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And that was very successful because you were changing enough habits that it was a lot easier than if you just tried to quit smoking.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, quitting smoking, you know, Mark Twain is credited with saying that quitting smoking is one of the easiest things in the world to do. He said, I myself have done it hundreds of times.
But I
think that one of the difficulties with quitting smoking is that it's primarily a negative goal.
Right.
So all of these situations in which you used to do something, now you're saying don't do it anymore. And by changing up a lot of things you're doing, part of what you're doing is taking all of these situations in which you used to grab a cigarette, for example, and associating those situations with doing something very different. For me, one of the big goals I had that had that character was that I used to bite my nails. From the time I was five, you know, and until I was in graduate school. So it was a pretty deeply ingrained habit. And and when I got to graduate school, I realized, well, you know, I tend to bite my nails at that point while I'm sitting at my desk reading articles. So I'd be sitting there reading, and my fingers would gravitate towards my mouth, and I would chomp on my nails. And what I did was, rather than focus on stop biting my nails, I actually realized that I needed to replace that behavior with something else, and I started buying desk toys. And so I have a Slinky, and I have these wind-up toys and cars and stuff like that. And now when I sit at my desk and I'm doing something, I play with desk toys. And I don't bite my nails anymore. So I'm in some ways addicted to desk toys, but I'm fine with that.
It's a healthier addiction.
Exactly.
Right. So, well, you've just illustrated a lot of things that you talk about later in the book that have to do with the environment. Because I just realized when I was reading, you know, I have a hard time remembering to floss my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took one of your ideas and just put the little flosser things right next to the toothpaste.
Yeah.
Which is really... You know, I mean, like you say, they've got to be right there for you to remember to do it.
Yeah. I think a lot of us don't appreciate how much the environment drives the things that we do all the time. We really are wired to do what's easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not thinking about flossing my teeth. You know,
right.
you like you're right. I went to the dentist last week and had my teeth cleaned and went around a couple of the teeth that was very, very inflamed. And so you go, oh, my God, you know, I should have been flossing my teeth this whole time, and I forgot. And so anyway.
It's terrible. And of course, you know, the thing about floss, you look at those floss containers, and they just scream out, throw me in a drawer. Right. I mean, so they're not sitting out in our environment. And as I say in the book, you know, we have furniture related to most of our toothbrushing experience. Right. I mean, people have cups and other things for their toothpaste and for their toothbrush.
Right.
And then the floss gets thrown in a drawer, and then you just don't think of it. And just by getting
it
out there in the environment.
You don't want to do it. It's just you never ever in your routine you just miss it. So.
Right. Right. So you get it out there in the environment, and it makes it much easier to make that a part of that daily routine. And then that first time you go to the dentist after you've been flossing for 6 months, it's you wonder, well, how could I have ever gone without flossing? This is so much easier.
Right. It is. It's a lot less painful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in Chapter 4, you is entitled Tame the Go System. You want to explain what the Go System is?
Sure. So I don't know how many of the listeners out there have ever seen a brain, or, you know, a picture of a brain, or maybe a brain in a vat. But a brain sort of looks like a pair of boxing gloves set the wrong way around with the fingers on the outside. It's kind of bumpier than your typical boxing glove. Gray in mm-hmm. color on the outside. And neuroscientists cleverly call that gray matter. If you cut into the brain a little bit, about a couple of millimeters down, it goes from gray in color to white in color, and neuroscientists cleverly call that white matter. That white matter is actually insulation on nerve fibers that are carrying information from one area of the outer part of the brain, the cortex, to another. If you were to continue to slice through that brain deeper and deeper into the brain, you eventually come to some more gray matter deep inside the brain. Those gray matter structures deep inside the brain are part of a set of brain structures called the basal ganglia, and those structures are really crucial, a crucial part of the system that drives your behavior and drives your habits. So what those brain systems are doing is they're taking your goals, they're engaging those goals, they're giving those goals some energy, and then pushing you towards behaviors, and particularly towards habits that you've performed before. Now, since the purpose of all of that circuitry is to get you to perform behaviors, I call it the go system, because it's designed to get you to do things. And then, every once in a while, you engage in a behavior that you don't want to perform anymore. So, for example, a year ago, I bought one of these cars that, in which you just sit down, the key doesn't go anywhere. You keep the key in your pocket, you just press a button, and now the car goes on. And so for a while, I would get in the car, and I'd pull my key out of my pocket, and I'd jam it into the steering column. And it would just clank off the steering column because there was nowhere to put it. And then there was a period of about a week where I'd pull the key out, and then stare at it, and then put it back in my pocket, because I had engaged that habit to jam the key into the steering column. And then something stopped me from doing that, because that was no longer a behavior that was useful in that situation. The system that gets you to stop doing things is what I call the stop system. And it involves some brain circuits that are in the frontal lobes of your brain, kind of the fingers of that boxing glove right above your eyes. And the thing about that stop system is it is much less effective and efficient than the go system. So the go system is phylogenetically really old. It's the brain systems we share with rats and mice and deer. And it works really well. It engages our behavior. It gets us moving. The stop system, not so much. It's impaired by stress. If you ever remember that scene in the movie Airplane with Lloyd Bridges trying to talk this pilot down out of the sky, he's totally stressed, spends the whole movie saying things like, I picked the wrong week to stop smoking. Picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue, which is demonstrating the effect of stress, right? It's impaired by drugs and alcohol, which is why people drink and then do silly things. It's impaired by overuse. You know, you have a really hard day at work. Somebody's staring over your shoulder. You spend the whole day avoiding telling them to go stuff it. You get home and suddenly that beautiful ice cream in the freezer leaps out of the freezer and into your mouth.
Yeah.
So the trick in behavior change really is to reprogram that go system. And in order to do that, you have to take your goals and turn them into a set of behaviors that can actually be engaged. Now, one of the things that means is that you have to make sure that your attempts at behavior change get specific enough that they can make it onto your calendar, right? I mean, if you think about it, people will say things like, I want to learn to speak a foreign language. You know, or for me, when I was in my 30s, I said, you know what, I want to learn to play the saxophone. Now, ask yourself, what does it mean, I want to learn to play the saxophone? It means I don't know how to play it now. Someday in the future, I'd like to know how to play it. But that's not going to help you, right? In order to actually engage your go system, you have to figure out, okay, when am I going to play the saxophone? I got to buy one. I got to take lessons. What day of the week are my lessons going to be? What day of the week am I going to be practicing? What days? When am I going to be doing it? Where am I going to be doing it? And the reason you need to get down to that level of specificity is partly because the go system can't engage a goal to do something abstractly. It's got to engage a goal to do something mm-hmm. specifically. And then the other thing is, until you get down to that level where you're trying to get something onto your calendar, it's very hard to realize all of the conflicts and all of the things that are going to get in your way from achieving the goal that you want to achieve. Because it's only when you start trying to get something on your calendar that you realize, holy cow, I'm really busy. Where am I going to find the time to do this? What am I going to give up? And so it's really important to get way down to that very specific level and ask yourself, when am I going to do these things? Where am I going to do these things? Where are the resources going to come from to do this? What am I willing to give up in order to make this happen? And until you do that, it's very hard to actually make changes in your behavior.
Yeah, just a side note on things we do during the day that we didn't used to do. I mean, how many of us are spending an inordinate amount of time texting and doing emails that we didn't used to do at all?
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
It really is. I mean, I'm not sure that it's that, useful and time, that the time you put into it is really rewarded.
I think when people look back over a month-long period, they don't think, wow, the highlight of my month was that I answered 1,000 emails.
Right.
That's simply not the kind of contribution that you want to make in your life. And yet, email is really persistent, partly because because we know that those emails and texts will travel the world in milliseconds. So somehow we feel like they need to be answered in the speed with which they travel. And we have to get beyond that culturally. And then there's another piece, which is we have created a lot of habits around this. And the thing is, I like to point out that we're sort of like rats in being trained to press a bar when it comes to our cell phone type behavior and our email behavior. Because, if you train a rat to press a bar, you take a thirsty rat, you stick it in a box with a bar on it, and a way of giving it some water as a reward. And then every time it gets near the bar, you give it some water. And then after that, you only give it water if it walks near the bar, then if it touches the bar, then if it presses the bar. Once you get the rat pressing the bar, the ideal way to get that rat to press the bar over and over and over again is to reward it randomly about 40 or 50% of the time that it presses the bar. And if you look at people's cell phone behavior, what they're doing is whipping out that cell phone to check whether they've gotten a message at a rate where about half the time that they pull it out of their phone, there's something they need to do with it. So they're getting that little reward, sort of like the water, about half the time that they do it. And the only other place in the world that you see that kind of schedule of reinforcement is in Vegas when you watch people playing the slot machines, where that stuff is purposely built in. And so we have very, very strong, deep habits to be checking our email all the time, which is another reason why managing the environment ends up being so important. You got to make it hard to keep checking your email and to keep checking your cell phone.
Another side note, my mother was a PhD child psychologist in operant behavioralism, so I used to help her build these little boxes that you're talking about, and I actually met B.S. Skinner one time.
Oh, fantastic. I had a great
interest in psychology because I was a teenager when she was going through her PhD studies at University of Kansas. And so I helped her type her dissertation, and I read all the books she was reading. So that's part of my great interest in psychology.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah, my intellectual line runs back. You can always trace your kind of intellectual heritage by looking at your advisor and your advisor's advisors and so on. And I had two graduate advisors, and if you look at their intellectual history, both of them go back through B.F. Skinner. One of my advisors, her advisor was one of Skinner's students, and on the other side, my graduate advisor did a postdoc that was very influential in his career with someone who was one of B.F. Skinner's students. So I kind of go back through him and on both sides of my intellectual family tree.
Yeah, well, I just thought it was interesting that you compared our email checking behavior to a rat's pressing the bar, because
yeah.
I think it's really true.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Fantastic.
So, it is. Let's see. Where were we? We were talking about. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, no. We talked a little bit about creating plans specific enough to make sure that you're actually going to be able to engage that go system.
Okay. So once we engage the go system, the next chapter is on harness the stop system, and
yeah.
that would be like stopping smoking. You know, you're actually
yeah.
stopping a behavior.
Right, and of course, the problem with that stop system, like I said, it's really inefficient. The fact is, if you rely primarily on the stop system rather than reprogramming the go system, you're ultimately very likely to fail. It's you're riding the brakes and just begging for there to be a problem. Now, there are several things you can do to enhance the stop system. One of the things mm-hmm. that I recommend is to do a lot of stuff out there in public. Turns out if you look at most of the things that you do that you're not proud of, you do them in private.
Right.
Right. I mean, every once in a while, people get with a bad group of people and they do something silly. But a lot of the really dumb things we've done in our lives, we've done in private. And so,
right.
and that's because we, you know, this idea that we might do something shameful in public is a very powerful force. And so, getting yourself out there in public, you know, with a group of people, is one great way of enhancing that stop system, because now the cost of doing something bad is high, and so
right.
and so that really provides you with a way of keeping yourself in line, you know. But I think that another important thing to do is to really use as many resources as you can to help you in those situations in which you're facing a temptation. So it can be small things like, you know how it is when you go to the grocery store and you're really hungry?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly food just starts seems to leap into your cart. And it turns out
right.
that there's actually scientific evidence. You go to the grocery store and you need to eat, you actually buy more stuff you didn't intend to buy than if you go to the grocery store and you don't need to eat. What that means is, now here's the fascinating thing. You actually can inoculate yourself against the effects of needing to eat by just bringing a list. So it turns out people who go to the store with a list buy fewer things that they didn't intend to buy, even when they need to eat. So here what you're doing is you're helping the stop system by giving yourself a routine that involves something external to yourself. So you've got this list, and you're walking down the chip aisle, and it turns out you weren't planning on buying chips, but you're a little bit hungry. They look really good. So you look at the chips, and you think, I should buy those. Now you look down at the list. You go, but they're not on the list, and you keep on walking.
Mm-hmm.
So you can help yourself. But you have to, what you have to do is to enhance the stop system by using some things in the environment, by doing things in public so that there are other people there who are able to help you, rather than just relying on what we colloquially call willpower, to save us.
Like, when I was, stopping smoking, whenever I wanted a cigarette, I would chew on a cinnamon stick or, a plastic straw. Some
mm-hmm.
people, unfortunately, eat when they want a mm-hmm. cigarette, and that's
sure.
associated with gaining weight. So when you get that strong desire, like with nicotine, you really do need to do something, but just not smoking the cigarette.
Yeah,
and that's,
absolutely.
You know, that's how electronic cigarettes came out, and nicotine patches, and, you know, all of the things that probably aren't real good for you, because nicotine patches are, you know, just giving you a boost of nicotine, and you're trying to get over that habit. So that probably
yeah.
isn't the best thing.
No, that's right. I think that, you know, the fact that you need to do something is a great indication that go system needs to be satisfied. The go system
exactly.
ends up having
yeah.
to do something. The trick is to really try to do something that is ultimately healthier. And I think that,
right.
you know, in the grand scheme of things, I think that a patch or nicotine gum is healthier than cigarettes, because cigarettes are a particularly noxious delivery mechanism for nicotine. There's all sorts of other chemicals that go in as well.
Right.
So, you know, it's a, if you're thinking towards doing something that's better than what you're doing, you know, it's probably better to be using a patch or gum than it is to be smoking. But in the long run, you really want to create a set of behaviors like the ones you described, like chewing on gum or a cinnamon stick, in as a way of reprogramming the, what the system is doing to do something that is healthier overall. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the nicotine allergy is, I'm not allergy, the nicotine desire habit is probably gone in about a week or two. So
That's right.
I mean, it's kind of like cocaine or something. You know, you go through a period where you get over the physical addiction, but then you've got the habit addiction. You've got the, you know, every time I have a drink or a cup of coffee, I have a cigarette.
Right.
And then
right.
what I noticed is further out, you really want a cigarette when you're really happy or you're really sad.
Mm-hmm.
The extremes of emotion.
Yes.
And
yeah.
so that's where it's important to have a substitute.
That's right. It's important to have a plan for that. And part of the reason for that is because those strong emotions are ones that carry a lot of what psychologists call arousal, which is energy.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and that energy engages the motivational system. That's where that energy is coming from. And so the more energy you've got in that go system, the more it's going to drive you to want to do something. And if it's a, if you're in a situation that was associated with smoking, then you know that energy goes into wanting to have a cigarette. And by the way, right, that can even be there years after you have stopped smoking, right? Because it's still part of your memory, which is why you get smokers who sometimes will say, "I just woke up today, really wanted a cigarette." Now, they probably have lots of strategies by that time to help them avoid having that cigarette, but it doesn't mean that that desire is ever completely going away.
There is one way, though, to take that desire away sooner rather than later, and I'll tell you my example here. When I decided to quit smoking, I was in the military, and so I went to a psychiatrist, and I asked him to hypnotize me to stop smoking, which he did. And he really did it in an interesting way. He put an 18-gauge needle through the back of my hand after he hypnotized me, but he told me it wouldn't hurt, and it didn't. And then when the needle was in, he says, "I'm going to withdraw it, but you're only going to bleed out of this one hole." You know, there's two holes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when he withdrew it, I only bled out of one hole. It's a really nice demonstration of how powerful hypnosis is. And then he said, "You're not going to want a cigarette." And actually, I didn't really want a cigarette as strongly. You know, there were those small desires. But it went very quickly, and I was able to really easily quit smoking. On the other hand, my mother quit smoking when I told her she needed to when she was having major surgery, and then she didn't ever smoke again. But she told me she always wanted a cigarette.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
she did not undergo that hypnosis. So there's something about hypnosis that really can change your desire thoughts. Make them a lot less powerful.
Well, I think that there's a lot of things that you can do, and hypnosis is definitely one of the techniques. I also think, you know, another thing that's really fascinating about this to me is that the strength of the go system and also the strength of the go system for different people often differs a lot. So, you know, some of us are just blessed with a go system that doesn't get us into trouble very often, right?
Mm-hmm.
And other people aren't. And, you know, it's very hard for someone who generally speaking, you know, has a go system that doesn't drive them towards noxious things to do, that they look at the people who have trouble quitting smoking, or they look at the people who have trouble eating the right amount, and they think there's just what's wrong with that person that they're not able to do that. And what they're not recognizing is that there are just lots of individual differences in the strength of how that go system works, and that some people have to work a lot harder to overcome some of these habits than others do. And, you know, rather than looking negatively on someone who's struggling with that, just, you know, count your own blessings if you're that sort of person who doesn't have to struggle with that. Just count your own blessings that you don't have to.
Yeah, we were talking about this the other day in the office, that some people are really blessed with structure, organization, responsibility, you know, as they're growing up. They just have that in their environment. Their parents expect it. So, And then other children are raised in environments with no goals, no discipline, no boundaries. I mean, it must be terribly difficult for those people to develop good habits because there's just nothing in the environment that supports it.
I think that's right. You know, and one of the last sets of tools in the book is about the people in your world. And,
yeah.
you know, parents are parents and teachers and things like that are early influences on the creation of a lot of these habits. You know, we are wired to adopt the goals of the people around us. We are wired, you know, our goals are in almost in a literal sense contagious. So if you see somebody who does something, you tend to do it, which is the reason why if you're the child of a smoker, you're much more likely to smoke than if you are the child of non-smokers. So we learn this stuff early on, and we have to. You know, a story I love to tell, which I tell in the book, is that I had a baby deer born in my front yard, and within 24 hours it was up and walking, and it ran off with its mom, and within a year or so it had become a fine, upstanding member of the deer community. And you know, my kids, it took 2 decades before I could get my kids out of the house.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Now, why is that?
Yeah.
Well, it's largely because deer, they mature quickly, but they're remarkably stupid, right? They can't figure out how to cross the street. They never go to the store, you know. And our kids, you know, they manage to adapt to whatever the environment is. So the fact that they grew up with computers and iPads and all sorts of stuff like that, they can deal with that because they get several decades of training from us. But what that means is that human beings need to learn to do just about everything from the people around us. We're not wired to do much. And so, you know, when we leave our kids to fend for themselves, to figure out for themselves what they want and what they should do, we are in some ways doing them a disservice because what kids are really wired to do is to pick up on what's going on with the people around us. And if the adults, if the parents and the teachers around the kids don't provide that information, then they're going to pick it up from somewhere else. And often from other people who also don't have a lot of long-term life experience that may actually get kids on the right road. So that's one of the reasons why that early environment is so important.
So engaging with others, and part of that is deciding who you're going to spend your time with. You know, we all have opportunity in school to hang out with different types of people, and hanging out with the wrong crowd is one sure way to get into trouble quickly.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great evidence on this now, not just the anecdotal kinds of evidence, but, you know, if you look at the large-scale social network data and you see that, that lots of bad behaviors, whether it's smoking or eating too much or drinking too much, they run in social groups. If you hang out with other people who smoke, you're more likely to be a smoker. If you hang out with other people who drink too much, you're more likely to drink too much. And that means that when you want to change your behavior, it's important to take a hard look at your social network and figure out whether there are people that you're spending time with who are helping you to do the wrong thing. And if so, then you need to make some changes and actually find some people who are doing what you want to be able to do and start spending your time with them.
Now, in your book, you talked a little bit about a doctor at the Cleveland Clinic that made some changes in the company. You want to just mention that because it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I started the book out by talking a little bit about Dr. Mike Roizen, and I've had a chance. He's the chief wellness officer at the Cleveland Clinic, and I've over the years had a chance to interact with him quite a bit. And they did something really fascinating, which is that they really wanted to make their company healthier because they realized that a huge portion of the expenses that they had for employees were healthcare expenses. And so they figured if they helped their employees to engage in healthier behaviors, they would help them to save money on their health insurance. So they first defined very explicitly what it meant to be doing healthy things, and they created a set of measures they call the five normals, which are things like a normal body weight and normal blood pressure, being a non-smoker, things like that. After that, they created a whole series of programs that were designed to help people to move towards those five normals. So they changed the environment by banning trans fats from the campus, by banning smoking from the campus. They actually put farmers markets on all of their campuses so that people would have more ready access to fresh fruits and vegetables. They also had personal counselors people could work with if they were struggling with weight loss or smoking. They actually would fire people if they smoked on the campus. They actually fired several high-profile doctors for doing that. And in many ways, they helped people to plan for creating a lifestyle that was healthier. They gave people yoga classes. If there were four or more employees in a location that wanted to do a yoga class, they would actually bring a yoga instructor to them. And what they found was, what was fascinating about this is that the formulas for living a healthy lifestyle in the long term are actually not a closely guarded secret. You want to lose weight, we all know you're supposed to exercise more and eat less. You know, if you, and so it, that's not, it, the trick is not that we don't know what we're supposed to do. It's making that the habit, making that the routine part of our lives. And it requires a tremendous amount of social support to do that. And the Cleveland Clinic was so successful in doing that. Their employees lost collectively hundreds of thousands of pounds. They got lots of people to quit smoking. And over time, their healthcare spending actually went down, in an era in which nationwide healthcare spending is going up. And and that's really fascinating. And what they did was essentially to engage a lot of the processes that I talk about in Smart Change. And so I felt like that was a great story to tell, to really let people know that this stuff works.
Yeah, it also works in community. You know, if you set the community up to talk about it, to give positive reinforcement, you know, when someone's making a change, to notice it, you know, to, you know, to punish, like you say, when someone just refuses to follow the rules, that all works.
Yep.
Psychology. I mean, it's basic psychology.
Absolutely. And no, I think it's an incredibly important thing to do. I think it's important for communities to recognize that you can succeed at making these changes. And it actually introduces one of the last big things in the book, which is that while the book is mostly about how to help people to change their own behavior, in fact, all of the principles for behavior change are also the principles of influence. That is, the principles that will allow us to help other people to change their behavior. And a lot of what the Cleveland Clinic did was not just for a few people there to change their behavior, but for the organization to actually help a large number of people who were employees there to change their behavior. Because you know, it's funny, when we want to help other people change behavior, we often switch from behavior change to messaging. We think, you know, if I could just tell people the right thing, they'll do the right thing. But, you know, if you look at your own life, it's rare that somebody actually just tells you something and that creates a fundamental change in your behavior.
Right.
Instead, you know, you have to engage, you know, you have to get your goals right, you have to create the right kinds of plans, you have to make sure you deal with temptations, you have to manage that environment, you have to hang out with the right people. And so if you're trying to help other people change their behavior, you have to do all of those same things, you have to help people on all of those fronts, and then you're putting the community in the best possible situation to change its behavior.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour here. Would you like to give the audience your contact information?
Absolutely. So there's lots of different ways you can reach out to me. I have a website called smartthinkingbook.com that has information about all my books, Smart Thinking, Habits of Leadership, and Smart Change. You can find me on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn. If you just search Art Markman on any of those social media. I think I'm even on Pinterest. You can reach out to me there. You can feel free to email art.markman@gmail.com. I love to hear from people who are working with changing their behavior. And then the book itself is available more or less wherever books are sold, but Amazon and Barnes & Noble, it's on Kindle and Nook and all of those great things. And so there's lots of opportunities to reach out. And on the social media platforms, I also post links to the blogs that I do, as well as I've got a radio show and podcast that we've been doing out of Austin, Texas, called Two Guys on Your Head. A buddy of mine named Bob Duke and I spend a little time each week talking about an area of psychology and having some fun. So I invite people to check that out as well.
Yeah, you learn a lot doing radio. You really do. You talk
Absolutely.
To a lot of interesting people, and you figure out some fun things to do. I've been doing this radio show for 18 years, so you can imagine all the folks I've talked to.
That's fantastic. Yeah, we were having a great time. We've been on our show about 2 years now. And we just love it. It's we have a loyal group of listeners here in Austin, and a growing number of people out there in the podcast land. So it's a great medium. Absolutely,
it is. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Markman. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I guess on your next endeavor, if you'll let me know what it is, we'll have you back on, so you can help people live a better life and make changes they need to change without making themselves crazy.
Well, I appreciate the time today. It was great to talk to you and have a chance to share some stuff with your listeners. I'd love to have the chance to talk again sometime in the future.
All righty. Take care. This is Dr. Susan. Thank you. This is Dr. Susan Call with Temple's Health Radio Show. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Margaret Lynch on Tapping into Wealth, how emotional freedom techniques can help clear the path to making more money. That would be great if that really worked. On the 11th, we're interviewing Dr. Pia Orlean on Remembering Who We Are, Guidance on Healing the Human Condition. And on the 18th, Colleen Mario, Spiritual Telepathy, Ancient Techniques to Access the Wisdom of Your Soul. This is Dr. Susan Cobb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.